Welcome to Zebra Talks, where people living with hypermobility syndromes hear their experiences reflected in conversations with guest experts and fellow zebras living their best bendy lives. I'm your host, Dr. Libby Hinesley, physical therapist and author of Yoga for Bendy People. The information and opinions shared on this podcast should not be taken as medical advice and are not a substitute for diagnosis and treatment by a qualified healthcare professional. Today, I'm really glad to welcome Dr. Laura Ross to Zebra Talks podcast. Laura is a pelvic health physical therapist and sex counselor based in Decatur, Georgia, in the Atlanta area. She is passionate about helping everyone with a pelvis. Her special interests are inclusive care for all genders, pelvic pain, sexual health, and the intersection of pelvic health and athletic performance. Laura earned a doctorate of physical therapy from Northwestern University and the Pelvic Rehabilitation Practitioner Certificate through the Herman and Wallace Institute. She has additional training in PT for concerns specific to trans and gender expansive folks, including gender affirming surgeries, and earned the certificate in sexuality counseling for pelvic health therapists from Pelvic Global. Laura is a member of the APTA, WPATH, and ASECT. Prior to becoming a PT, Laura was a professional oboist for 10 years, playing in studios, symphonies, operas, and ballets in Nashville. When not in the clinic, you'll find her at the gym, working out, or coaching at the Atlanta Women's Barbell Club, reading, cooking, spending time in nature, or out and about with her partner. All right, Laura, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you on today, and I'm really excited about our conversation.
Thank you for having me, Libby. I'm really excited to be here, too.
Great. Today, we're going to talk about the overlap between hypermobility and gender-affirming care. So I'd like to start out by having you talk a little bit more about your work and share a bit about your own personal journey, about how you came to do the work that you do now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I treat all genders of folks in a wide range of pelvic health concerns. So our clinic really treats everybody. But I would say most of my caseload is either pelvic pain or sexual concerns or pelvic PT for folks who weightlift. And so I identify as a queer woman, and I've had some challenging medical experiences myself, particularly related to gynecologic care. So one of the things for me that's really important is making a safe space for folks like me, and in particular, making a safe space for my trans siblings to make sure that everybody has access to good care. And I was really lucky. My best friend in PT school was an advocate and an ally for care for trans folks. And so even in PT school, we were talking about these issues, trying to find ways to make space for that. And so I started learning about caring for this population even when I was in school. So I knew that from the beginning of my career, I wanted to be able to treat everybody with a pelvis. And so it's just been kind of growing from there.
That's fabulous. Talk a little bit about your experience specifically with hypermobility.
Yeah, I think in pelvic health, we just have a rather high proportion of folks who come in with pelvic health concerns that are hypermobile, whether they realize it or not. So I think I've done a whole lot of reading, and I have great mentorship in our clinic from Beth Kemper, who knows a lot about hypermobility. And I think a lot of it has also been just trial and error, working with patients, figuring out what is the best way to build strength programs for them, to really get the right kind of inputs for them. So I think I've also been working with hypermobile folks for my whole career.
Yeah, definitely. As a pelvic PT, you would be and just have to learn about it along the way. I'd love for you to set up the lay of the land a little bit as we're going to talk about gender-affirming care. If you could give us some terminology, some definitions, so that we can all know what we're talking about throughout the rest of our conversation would be great. Kind of terms that you think are really important for everyone to understand and that get very often confused or misused.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll make the disclaimer that terminology is ever evolving. So folks may have specific terms for themselves that are just unique to them. And so it's always good to ask how folks identify or what words they want to use. And also depending on the age and the generation of the person that you're working with, they may use terms for themselves that may seem more outdated to our ears, but they still work for those folks. So it's a very open thing, but there are, I think, some basic guidelines. And it's also okay for us as practitioners to acknowledge whatever dead angles we have. And just if we say something that doesn't feel good for a person in front of us, that we can just apologize and move on for that. But just in terms of general guidelines, so first we can talk about what is sex assigned at birth. and want to make it clear that that's different than biological sex. So biological sex is more of a complex interaction between chromosomes, karyotypes, hormones, all different kinds of things. Sex assigned at birth is generally given based on external genitalia. So that's usually written as assigned male at birth or assigned female at birth, AMAB, AFAB. And just want to also bring up the fact that there is a controversial and frankly ongoing practice of choosing the gender for intersex folks, so that that's, you know, still ongoing. So sex assigned at birth is one specific thing. And then when we're speaking about gender identity, that is one's deeply felt, inherent sense of being, which is not necessarily visible, but it's how they feel their internal gender is. And that's usually along a masculine or feminine spectrum of things. And one's affirmed gender identity is the person's gender identity after either coming out as trans or non-binary, undergoing a social or medical transition. And so an affirmed gender identity, however, does not require surgery, does not require genital surgery or even hormones. It can be a combination of those things, or it can be none of those things, and folks can still have an affirmed gender identity. Cisgender means that your gender identity matches the sex assigned at birth. Transgender is when your gender identity does not match your sex assigned at birth. So folks who are trans could be of a binary gender, or they could be of a non-binary gender. When we talk about transmasculine, sometimes abbreviated transmasc, that would be folks that are more on the masculine spectrum, and then transfeminine or transfem would be on the more feminine spectrum. And the non-binary indication is not necessarily within those binary constructs. So we can talk about folks might identify as gender queer, gender non-conforming, gender non-binary, gender neutral, perhaps two-spirit, gender fluid. There are lots of different terms that folks use to identify. And just it's important to recognize that all of this exists on a spectrum. I think it's really important that even as we are affirming our trans siblings, we make sure to take care to not push folks into a binary box. So I think when we're talking about genital surgeries, for example, we're thinking about transitioning between binary genders, but it tends to be a lot more complex than that. And there's a really wide spectrum of how folks identify and how folks want to claim their identity. And so I think we need to be open for that as well. When we speak about gender expression, so that would be more of the presentation of the individual. And so that is physical appearance, clothing choice, behaviors, and that may or may not conform to their gender identity, and that may or may not be the same day to day. So it might be how folks show up on a given day. And then I think many of us should be familiar with identifying pronouns. And so it's also, again, important to ask folks what their pronouns are, because that can be anything from he, they, he, him, she, her, she, they, them, Z, G, lots of different types. And so just asking folks what are their pronouns and identifying yourself as a provider with pronouns as well can be really helpful.
Great. Thank you so much for taking us through all of that terminology. That's really helpful and hopefully gives people some of the landscape of how to understand some of these issues that we're talking about today. And certainly whether you're a healthcare provider or not, it's really important in whatever space you are and have influence on, be explicitly inclusive and know how to welcome people in. And I loved how you pointed out gender expression might be really different day to day, and it might be context dependent. So however someone is presenting, say in a medical setting, might be really different than how they might present in a social setting or otherwise. And some of that, I'm sure, plays into the unfortunate experiences that many queer people are going to have in a lot of different healthcare settings. Well, let's talk about what do we know about the overlap between hypermobility and all of the things we've just talked about. Like, what is this all about as far as we know?
Yeah. You know, we were speaking a little bit before we started recording about the fact that I think that this connection between hypermobility and gender diversity is really just now being more well recognized. And so I think that it's going to take a few years for research to necessarily catch up, but there is some evidence emerging as far as the connection between that. So I think that at this point, it's really hard to know why that connection exists, but I think we do have some good evidence describing pretty strongly that that connection exists. So I would say probably the article that I found that is the most stark in that is a 2022 article by Najafian et al. Apologies if that's pronounced differently. But talking about gathering evidence from, I think it's OHSU, their gender-affirming surgery program, and the overlap of people who have EDS. And the really headline statistic from that is that the prevalence of an EDS diagnosis in their patient population who were getting gender-affirming surgeries was 132 times the highest reported prevalence in the general population, which is amazing.
It is. It's shocking.
Yeah. And so I think that probably is the most stark example. And what I liked in this article too is that they really did a good job, I think, of pairing non-EDS controls with that. And interestingly, in that study, and I think this is consistent with what we find in EDS literature as well, 67% of the patients were assigned female at birth. So the majority were assigned female at birth, which I think is consistent with what we know about the prevalence of EDS. Yeah. And then the other significant thing that they found, which I also observe in my practice, is that there was not a higher rate of complications for wound healing in folks with EDS, which I think is significant because I think that's always been a concern when we're talking about any sort of skin or wound healing for folks with EDS because of some of the skin issues that can be present. And so that was encouraging, I think, to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as you mentioned, some of this is hard to understand accurately because the prevalence of all the different pieces that we're discussing are really hard to nail down. You know, the prevalence of EDS itself is a really a moving target. But nonetheless, that's a really stark number that you pointed out from that study. And that study was quite a large sample size, I believe. If I remember that correctly.
I think so, yeah. So they actually matched 36 patients with EDS with 108 without. And that was like, of the total patients that they looked at, it was 1,363. But I mean, yeah, I would say for what they were looking for, a decent sample size for sure.
Yeah, great. And then are there other papers that describe some of the overlaps here that help us understand these connections?
Yeah, I think there were probably two more notable that I want to just bring up. One is a 2022 paper by Jones et al., which was about gender dysphoria in adolescents with EDS. And so this is kind of looking at it from the flip side, where folks that were being seen in a multidisciplinary EDS clinic, and then how many of those identify as gender diverse or have gender dysphoria. So for that, what they found is of the 166 adolescents seen in a multidisciplinary EDS clinic, 28 or 17% reported gender dysphoria and were included in the analysis. And just for reference, the national estimate average based on 2017 estimates for folks with gender dysphoria is 1.3%. So in that clinic, it was 17. Okay.
Interesting.
So again,
wow,
just a really high percentage of overlap.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting as well, not only in this study, but I think also in the previous study that I mentioned, in addition to reporting symptoms that we are used to with folks with EDS, like fatigue, musculoskeletal issues, things like that, they also brought up mental health concerns as a really high preponderance in both cases. So I think that we also want to be mindful of that. And again, hard to know because there's a higher prevalence in folks with EDS separate of gender diversity. And that's a conversation worth having as far as, you know, constant pain can obviously contribute to mental health challenges. And then the same thing with being in as a gender diverse person in society, that's a really prevalent thing that happens is any kind of mental health issue. So I think when you have both of them together, I think it's just notable for us to bring that up as well.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. We've got two populations that now we're seeing are often the same population that have been through a lot of different levels of gauntlet as people trying to seek services and seek care in the world and experiencing a lot of dismissiveness, gaslighting, and mistreatment on all fronts. So that's a perfect storm
for
some mental health challenges and challenges in feeling empowered to understand one's own experiences and make decisions accordingly. And so that's just such a huge role that any healthcare practitioner has to play for people, so restoring that sense of agency and empowerment. And hopefully we just do that better and better all the time as individuals out there working.
Yep.
And I'll just say, this is a good moment for awareness raising that if we care about hypermobility care, we also care about trans healthcare and access to care. And especially when you bring up this study about adolescents with gender dysphoria and what we're seeing across the country in many, many state legislatures, really making it difficult to impossible to criminal to seek gender-affirming care. This is a big issue, and it should be an issue for the hypermobility community as well.
Yeah, I think it's clear from statistic after statistic that gender-affirming care is life-saving care, full stop. So yeah. I think that it's really about people, allowing folks to be who they are and be given the basic human right of access to healthcare. It's truly nothing more controversial than that. It's just
That's true.
Basic human rights.
Yep, it's true. It's not really an argument to be made about that.
No. One more article I could actually bring up, if that's okay, that I thought was kind of interesting.
Absolutely. Yes, please.
So one other article that I found actually talked about POTS and the use of testosterone for gender-affirming care. And so that was pretty interesting because we know that, of course, POTS is a very common comorbid factor for folks who have EDS. So this was a case study. So a series of three patients who were assigned female at birth and also had EDS as well as POTS and being treated issues related to that. And then how did that change with the inclusion of gender-affirming testosterone care? And so one very interesting thing that they found is that all three patients in the study demonstrated apparent clinical improvement in their POTS symptoms with the addition of supplemental testosterone. So again, it's more of we don't really know why that is, but it is an interesting observation. And of course, we know that it's more prevalent to have POTS in females in the U.S. than it is in males. So it's kind of an interesting overlap there.
It definitely is. I'm actually really glad you brought that up because I have heard from people just anecdotally, patients, clients, many of them have experience with gender-affirming care, and that's the context for their testosterone use and all people assigned female at birth that I'm thinking of. But others who are also on testosterone, not for gender-affirming care, but for some other hormonal reason connected to their health, and they have hypermobility syndromes, and they love the testosterone because it makes them feel so much better. Have you seen that in your clinical practice as well?
I can't say that I've noticed that in specific, but I just thought that that was interesting because I do see folks that we address or have to manage some of their POTS symptoms while we're in the clinic. And so it's something that I hadn't necessarily connected. And so I thought that was a pretty interesting article. That's by Boris et al. From 2019.
That's great. It is interesting. I'd love to know more about that, and maybe we'll learn more about that over time. But I've definitely heard people report improvements in their joint pain and sense of stability. I would assume that we'll have an easier time building muscle with a little bit of extra testosterone on board. But we do know that, as you mentioned before, the prevalence of HSD and HEDS and all these things is higher among people assigned female at birth. And it's thought that the expression of these conditions and the genetics behind them is partially hormonally mediated. So it is interesting to see how some of this hormonal stuff might play out and change people's symptom presentation. All right, so let's talk about the person with a hypermobility syndrome who is seeking gender-affirming surgery and some of the things that we need to be aware of as far as preoperatively, postoperatively, the whole rehab scenario here.
Yeah, that's a great question. And when you invited me to have this conversation, I was looking back through my caseload of folks that I have supported either before or after gender-affirming surgery, and that runs the gamut of, you know, top surgery, bottom surgery, both phalloplasty and vaginoplasty. I would say that many of them have hypermobility. Some are aware of it, some are not necessarily, but of course, as clinicians, we have certain observations we make about how their bodies move and how things are working. So I do think it's been notable in my practice. And I think I agree, like I said, with what that study from OHSU found. I don't notice any particular complications as far as the wound healing process goes. But where I do think it's important to note is really just thinking about pelvic health concerns that we would with the general bendy population. So what I mean by that is, of course, if you're having some stability challenges, let's say in the hip and your back, your pelvic floor may try to do a lot to help. So I've heard a mentor say once that the pelvic floor is kind of like the Peace Corps muscles. So whenever they need help somewhere else, it's like, ooh, can I help here? Ooh, do I need to help there? And in that case, what happens is it's taking away from the general normal function of the pelvic floor when it's working hard to stabilize. So particularly when we're speaking about gender-affirming bottom surgeries, one of the things that we emphasize in prehab is making sure that you can really connect with your pelvic floor prior to surgery, because there will be changes anatomically. And so if you can really locate in your brain where that pelvic floor is, you know, can you fully lengthen that? Can you contract that just like other muscles in your body? Are you able to have healthy bowel function before surgery, which is again important for everybody that we're seeing before surgery, because that anesthesia really slows down bowel movement. So any trouble that you're having before is going to be magnified after. So we really want to make sure that that is functioning tip top. And then it might mean some changes to what we do for basic strengthening before. So for all of these gender affirming bottom surgeries in particular, there's going to be some significant time off your feet and not really doing a whole lot. So you really want to go in with a good head of steam as far as good muscle mass, good strength. And so really trying to emphasize doing a lot of strengthening before the procedure. So of course, for bendy folks, we're going to want to be mindful about the dosage of that and the way that we progressively overload, depending on how that works for the person. We may be spending a little bit more time on things like some hip stability, some single leg work, just to make sure that that's really feeling tip top. So again, we can make sure the pelvic floor is able to do its own job. So I think those are probably the biggest things that come to mind from that standpoint. And then the other thing I just want to bring up too, that is a little bit of an overlap with neurodivergence and gender diversity, as well as hypermobility, because I've noticed an overlap there as well. Something when we're working with folks surrounding bottom surgery is sensation. There's a lot of changes in how the nerves go through the pelvis during the surgery, particularly when we're talking about a phalloplasty. So a lot of the prehab work and then the rehab work involves restoring sensation to a satisfactory level for those folks. And so we know that folks that already have some sensory differences in the way they process information, whether that's because of hypermobility or because of neurodiversity. So I think we need to be mindful about working collaboratively with patients and being patient as a clinician about, okay, maybe we need to use a slightly different cue for that. Maybe we need to use slightly different language around how that looks and feels for you. Maybe we need to use different inputs. We use dry needling a lot in our practice, and so maybe that's more helpful for them to connect than doing another kind of tactile cue. So lots of different things to consider, but I would say those are probably the major considerations that I think about in this population.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we could bring up a lot of different Venn diagrams when we talk about hypermobility, but one relevant for today is gender diversity, hypermobility, and neurodivergence. We know that there's a big overlap there. There's a lot that we don't understand there. But do you want to share anything more about that, just to highlight that for folks who are making these connections?
Yeah, I mean, I really wish I had more studies about that, but I don't. But I can say that for me, as a clinician, particularly working in pelvic health at a baseline, I assume that everybody has had some kind of trauma, and then I assume that everybody has some kind of neurodivergence. And so if those things are not present or not present to a high degree, then that's great. I've at least accounted for that. But in my mind, I'm setting up that that's kind of where our baseline of operations is going to be. So for me, recently, I feel like if I have a person walking into my office that I know is gender diverse as well, I'm trying to pick up on some of those things too. And for some of these, I mean, folks may not be disclosing neurodivergence, which is totally fine. They may not be disclosing history of trauma. They might not be even disclosing things about their gender, which is A-okay. But I think it's just trying to be very observant and open as a clinician so that you can be prepared for different needs of folks, so that we're really not only having signage that's inclusive, but really within your visits with folks, being able to be as inclusive of whatever particular specific needs the individual in front of you has.
Yeah, good tips all around. We should probably all just assume those things, history of trauma and being somewhere on the neurodiverse spectrum. Can you describe some of the surgeries for us so that we understand some of the terms you've used? What are they called? What happens? What's the rehab and recovery process like?
Sure. So gender-affirming surgery is very, very wide. I think that when people are thinking about a gender-affirming surgery, they're usually only thinking about a bottom surgery, so something pertaining to the genitals. But gender-affirming surgeries encompass everything from facial feminization surgeries to laryngeal shaving, top surgeries, either masculinizing or feminizing. So it really is lots of different things. For my practice, there's not a lot of prehab and rehab to be done kind of above the neck, but I do work with folks generally before and after masculinizing top surgery. So restoring shoulder mobility, thoracic mobility, doing some scar work, things like that. And then when we're talking about gender-affirming bottom surgeries, a feminizing bottom surgery could be either a vulvoplasty or a vaginoplasty. And there's different surgical approaches for both. So that would be creating a neo-vagina in the vaginoplasty. And for the vulvoplasty, it is more of a cosmetic appearance of a vulva rather than actually creating some kind of an invagination. Mm-hmm. And then for the masculinizing bottom surgery, the two surgeries performed are a metoidioplasty and a phalloplasty. The phalloplasty being far more complex and multi-stage. So that would be creating a phallus partially out of a flap of either the forearm, the lat, or the inner thigh. And then there's a lot of microvascular surgery that's involved in that. So that would be a multi-stage procedure where there's a hysterectomy, a closing of the vaginal space, and then the addition of the phallus, as well as scrotal tissue, which is coming from labial tissue. Metoidioplasty is slightly different, where it is based on a urethral lengthening based on clitoral tissue that has been exposed to testosterone for a longer period of time and grown to a satisfactory length for that client. And so it kind of depends on what your tissue availability is, which ones are those are best. Yeah, there's a lot of other personal factors into why one would choose one or the other. Fewer sensation challenges present with a metoidioplasty than a phalloplasty because it is natal clitoral tissue that is just grown into be a phallus. Mm-hmm. But it kind of depends on what the main goal of the person is, how affirmed they feel with various different types. That is a really cursory explanation of that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more in depth that we could go into, but that's the basic lay of the land of that.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. It sounds like these are really complex surgeries, and I imagine they are going to involve a pretty complex recovery period or prolonged recovery period, depending on a variety of factors. So what does that recovery period usually look like?
That is complicated and very different mm-hmm. depending on the person. And I will also say it's complicated mm-hmm. by the fact that in my state, in Georgia, there is actually nobody who performs gender-affirming bottom surgeries. And so my
In the whole state of Georgia.
That's right. To my knowledge, there may be, but I live in the Atlanta area and that doesn't exist here. So the clients which I have are flying out of state for these procedures.
Wow.
So, but please, if someone is listening to this podcast and you do so, please let me know because I've been looking mm-hmm. for that. But to my knowledge, no. And that is true of several of our neighboring states as well. So, you know, there are large centers in other parts of the U.S. where these surgeries are performed. So many times what happens for these folks is that they are going to the place to have the procedure. They are staying for several weeks after for immediate post-op care, and then they're returning for additional care. So we certainly do have medical providers in this area who are comfortable with helping with wound healing in that area from those procedures. So trying to develop a network here locally of the most multidisciplinary support that we can, but it's not as ideal in, say, a place like San Francisco or Portland or Chicago, where they have all these folks just in the whole team in the area where folks mm-hmm. can just be in their home environment. So yeah, I think it kind of depends on where the person lives for these procedures. Mm-hmm. It is really common for travel to occur. So when we're talking about wound healing, it's really similar to other procedures as far as timeframes go. But I think we really want to look at a long game as far as the resumption of sensation and things like that. That can be a year plus process, depending. And particularly with something like a phalloplasty, where it's often at least a 3-stage procedure. So there's some recovery present after each procedure, and then after you have all the procedures done, and then waiting for that.
And that restoration of sensation, does that primarily have to do with the length of time that nerves require to heal and to adapt?
Yeah, so what should happen is, in terms of the micro neurovascular surgery, they're reattaching pudendal terminal nerves to whatever the nerves that are coming from the donor site in a phalloplasty. And so there's some newer protocols that I've been using for prehab to start building some of those pathways even before a procedure. So credit to OHSU on that one as well. But yes, there's a lot that has to do with just nerve healing time. And I have to say that that's something that I'm trying to improve upon myself to get better outcomes for patients. And I think the key to that is getting some prehab in on some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah, you're putting me on the spot, Libby. I didn't study up for that. So
well, it sounds like you did.
So yes, that's a place of ongoing learning for me about how to do that better for patients using the tools that we have available. There are some surgeons who spend more and less time focusing on restoring sensation. But then I think there's quite an overlap in what I do with my sex counseling work as well. So trying to make sure that folks have adequate genital sensation for the type of activities that they want to engage in. So there's a little bit of a physical process. There's a little bit of a counseling process that can happen in that, using a lot of external tools, whether that's, again, using dry needling for some of that healing, using external vibration and other sensory-focused things to try to work on some of that. But I would say sensation is a major challenge, particularly with a phalloplasty. But with any of these big genital surgeries, there's a pretty significant recovery time for that.
Do you find that your work as a sex counselor comes in heavily to your whole landscape of being a pelvic PT? I see that combination a lot, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yes. After going through the program last year, I think it completely changed the way I practice. I think being able to really look holistically at the concerns that folks are coming to us with. And so if we're really just addressing a physical issue when it comes to, let's say, painful sex of some kind, I think we're really leaving a lot on the table. And I've noticed that it really gives a much more complete treatment for patients when we can really address some of the emotional, relational, sociocultural, interpersonal factors that affect whatever is going on. And so I think some patients will come in surprised, thinking that they're just coming for like, okay, I have pain with sex, we're working on the physical thing, this is what we're doing. And then I start asking them a bunch of questions and they're like, oh yeah, actually that does kind of matter for what we're talking about. And I think that it's also bled into other things, not just sexual related concerns, just being able to really appreciate some of the ways our body may manifest even sociocultural things that are happening. So being able to be sensitive to some of those things.
That's great.
I think I just want to leave folks with the fact that I think that every healthcare provider should really have basic competencies in working with gender diverse folks. Because I think that in pelvic health, that gets put front and center because obviously we're having sensitive conversations around the genitals all day long with everybody. So folks that are already feeling kind of sensitive about what their genitals are and how they feel about them, you want to be careful about that. But you know what? Non-binary people might have back pain, or a trans person might have a headache that they need work for. So it's just, we are all people who have lots of different needs within the medical space. And so I think that to pigeonhole that pelvic health PT, oh, you're going to be experts on working with trans and gender diverse folks. Maybe, but I really would love for everybody to have basic competencies in this. And so it's important for me to get that message out in places like this where it might not be top of mind, but just to say that taking some time to learn how to approach that population in a way that is inclusive and not intrusive, I think is important. So I'm really a big advocate, particularly since we're noticing these overlaps in these communities. So if you specialize in working with folks with EDS and hypermobility, you should be aware that this is a common thing that may happen in this population, or vice versa, the same way I've had to be aware in working with this population that, okay, I really need to bone up on my knowledge of how to work with folks with hypermobility. So I just think that it's really important to appreciate some of these intersections and then really be able to hone in on the individual in front of you and really individualize whatever treatment it is that they need, whatever needs they have in terms of affirming their identity while you're treating them, I think is super important.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there some resources that you can share both for practitioners as well as patients in this realm?
Yeah. So in terms of patients, there are a few great places to search for a provider who is affirming. So the first one is OutCare. So that's outcarehealth.org, and you can just put in your location and the type of practitioner that you want. Another one is QueerMed, so queermed.com. There's also the LGBTQ plus healthcare directory, so that's a free searchable database, and that's lgbtqhealthcaredirectory.org. And then the other thing I would say that as a patient, you are perfectly within your rights to Google the provider that you're going to see. See what their website looks like. Is that a place that you want to go? And it's perfectly okay to call a provider to say, like, hey, have you worked with a person like me before? And I think I'm perfectly comfortable talking with folks that have concerns about that. And so I think that any provider that doesn't will give you all the information that you need. And then as far as practitioners, I can speak to some of the education that I've had, which is primarily in the pelvic health space. So I know there are a couple of really great courses. Sandy Gallagher has a couple of excellent courses that I know are now being hosted at Pelvic Global, but she's also taught for the APTA and Herman and Wallace. I think there Herman and Wallace has a few other courses specific for LGBTQ folks and working with that. I think that there's a lot of great accounts on Instagram for learning about this. Christina Holland is one that comes to mind. She does a lot of great work with inclusive care generally. But I think that there are a lot of us that are doing this work and trying to put out content that is helpful for folks. So I think that really just doing some of your own Googling is also helpful. The information about terminology that I have is something that you can also find on a basic Google search. So it's not even like you need to take a weekend course on some of this stuff. Just start reading. Yeah. Start reading and hearing experiences of trans and gender diverse folks. Just hearing about how they were treated and how they would prefer to be treated. I think just start.
Yeah, same skill set when it comes to being a resource for anyone with a hypermobility syndrome. I tell patients all the time, you're not going to find anyone who knows about these conditions, at least in our area, or it'll be really unlikely. But what you want to find is someone who is curious and wants to learn and is simply affirming of your experience. Boom, and you've got a unicorn, and that's where you want to start.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, thank you so much. How can listeners find out more about you and what you're putting out there in the world?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. You can check out our practice's website, which is kemperpt.com. And you can email me there. I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody has. So it's just laura@kemperpt.com. I do have an Instagram. I post a little more infrequently than I used to these days, but it is Dr. Laura Ross, and certainly happy to connect with folks there as well. I'm not the fastest at responding to DMs, but I will try. So certainly happy to connect with anybody that has questions or wants to tell me I said something wrong, or yeah, I would love that.
Great. Well, again, thank you so much for sharing your experience, your insight. The work that you do is so important, and thank you on behalf of all other humans for doing what you do. Yeah. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Bye for now.